Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, Dr. Michael D'Angeli of the Get HIEX Dancers will preview their dance workshop and performance at UAS this weekend. And Andy Bartholomew will tell us about the KXLL showcase during the Folk Festival. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here live and local on a Juno Afternoon. It is currently a very warm 43 degrees at the Juneau International Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton in for Antonia Gonzalez. A major Dutch bank is selling its $120 million share of the loan for the Dakota Access Pipeline. ING said the decision comes after dialogue with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which has protested the construction near their reservation in North Dakota. Reuters reports the financial giant said there was less room for lenders to influence the project after a U.S. judge last week ruled against efforts to halt its completion. Oil is expected to start flowing through the pipeline as soon as this week. Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairman Dave Archambault, in a statement Tuesday, applauded ING's decision to remove itself from a project he says tramples on the rights of sovereign nations. The five tribes of the Bears Ears National Monument in Utah are expecting a visit this month by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. In a letter last week, the newly selected Bears Ears commissioners invited Zinke to discuss management priorities, and they expressed concerns about the future of the monument under President Donald Trump's administration. James Adakai, a commissioner from the Navajo Nation, hopes Secretary Zinke will come to Monument Valley ready to listen to local community members.
To pretty much demonstrate that, you know, the support is there. And as a local tribal leader, the county that we're in Sawan County, Utah, we're pretty much left out from the whole process.
Some Utah lawmakers and county officials are urging President Trump to undo the controversial monument, which President Obama designated in the final days of his presidency. Still, Adakai is hopeful that plans to protect the monument for traditional access of the tribes will continue to move forward.
The Antiquities Act, which was used for President Obama to establish this designation, has never been challenged. And I really don't think the Trump administration will just do away with the whole thing, you know, because it's never been done before.
The Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition is a partnership of the Hopi, Navajo, Uinta and Ara Ute, Ute Mountain Ute, and Zuni governments. Virginia congressmen are renewing a years-old effort to grant federal recognition to six Virginia tribes. U.S. Senators Mark Warner and Tim Kaine reintroduced the bill last month. It would recognize the Chickahominy, the Eastern Chickahominy, the Upper Mattapani, the Rappahannock, the Monacan, and the Nansemond tribes. Chief Lee Lockamy of the Nansemond tribe says the change would allow the tribes to seek federal funding for things like housing, education, and medical care.
There's a lot of programs because we're state recognized, but we're not federally recognized that we can't do. It's like the Smithsonian is holding about 200 of our remains of the Nansemond tribe, but they won't give them to us because we're not federally recognized.
Versions of this proposal have been around for nearly two decades, and while Lockamy is hopeful for the bill's chances of passing this year, he says the opposition has been slow to back down.
A lot of it's still prejudice. You know, you're Indian, so what? We can still get a lot of that good old boy network. Yeah, for some reason they wanted to wipe the Indians off the planet, but, you know, we're still here.
According to Senator Kaine's office, the bill has passed the U.S. House of Representatives twice in the past, but has never made it to a vote on the Senate floor. Two Native Americans are among the recipients of this year's prestigious Bush Fellowship. The fellows from Minnesota and the Dakotas each receive $100,000 to build leadership skills in their fields of choice. Melissa Marie Boyd of the Mille Lacs Indian Reservation plans to study multilingual education and behavior design to help revive the Ojibwe language in schools. Heather Dawn Thompson is a national expert in Indian law and member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. She wants to use her fellowship to gain expertise in economic development to assist the Great Plains tribes in building self-sufficiency. I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support great causes like National Native News. Just select KNBA-FM Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Support by Bears Ears National Monument, created to honor tribes and protect traditional access. You can tell President Trump to honor tribes and protect Bears Ears at protectbearsears.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, March 2017. It's about 5 minutes, 6 minutes after the hour. Scott Burton, your host, and my first guest today is UAS Professor Dr. Mikeyel D'Angeli. She is here to tell us about the Get Hi-X Dancers that are doing a workshop on Friday and then a performance on Saturday. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, and Alex, and for having me. We are very excited, my husband, artist and carver, Mike D'Angeli, and I, to bring our dance group, the Get Hi-X, to Juneau for our very first full-length performance here. We've shared songs informally here and there, but we've never brought our dance group, our dancers up from Vancouver, BC, where we're based. So we're bringing six dancers here, and we're going to be sharing songs that are our inherited rights, so ancient songs as well as songs that have been gifted to us that are more recently created, and then songs that my husband and I have created together. So he's a composer and I'm a choreographer, and we both started out together as carvers. So we work on the majority of the masks and regalia that you see are made by my husband and his apprentice, who's also in our dance group. And I work together with them as well.
All right. So you came together, or this group came together in 2003, is that right?
Well, the group was founded actually in 1999 by my husband, and he led it on his own with just a few members until 2003 when I joined, and we both started to share the leadership of the group. And since then, it's expanded at the largest amount of dancers we've had in and out is 60 dancers, 40 active, and right now this smaller group that we're traveling with, we're these are, I'd say, our most well-trained dancers, and they're trained to dance all the masks that we have and headdresses. We're bringing up probably about 35 masks and headdresses. And we're going to be sharing an hour and a half worth of our songs and dances, and then followed by Q&A. And that's on March 25th, Saturday, at the Egan Library. And the question-answer period is something that is a rare opportunity for us. We like to offer that, especially at universities, because it creates for a deeper engagement with our witnesses, with our audience, and their understanding of what it is that we just shared with them.
Okay. Tell us more about the dance group. I understand there are 9 different nations involved.
Mm-hmm. When my husband and I first started to reorganize a group in 2003, he's Nisga'a and I'm Tsimshian. Those are, I would say, our primary nations. That's where our names come from. And we decided that we were going to focus on some Algic-speaking people, so those nations that speak our language. So that was the Tsimshian, Nisga'a, and Gitxsan. But it came to light fairly quickly as people started to join our dance group that we had to be more inclusive, because our people were married to Haidas and Haislas and Tlingit people. And so the numbers of nations within our dance group expanded. And this is fairly common with dance groups in the U.S. They call them intertribal dance groups. In Canada, multi-nation dance groups. And we really fulfill the need for our community in Vancouver, because there are many more nations of people who live in that area that aren't from there, that don't have a dance group where they can sing the songs and dances that come from their people. But the majority of the songs and dances we share are Niska and Tsimshian songs.
Okay. Speaking of inclusivity, I've read something about how people are invited at this dance workshop, are invited to dance with you, and then there might be a special dance on Saturday during your performance. Can we start with the dance workshop? Tell us what that's going to look
like.
Sure.
So on Friday, March 24th at 6 o'clock in the dance studio at the Rec Center from 6 to 8 o'clock, we're going to offer a dance workshop. So we're going to share with our local community here some of our practices as a dance group, all focused on a song that was written by David Nelson III of Metlakatla, Alaska. And I say Alaska because there's two Metlakatlas. A song that he gifted to us, to me in particular, that honors our women. And we felt that it was really appropriate to focus on a women's honor song in the aftermath of the election and the Women's March. So this is a time for all of us in all of our various ways and expression to also do the work of holding up our women, and this is part of ours. So in this workshop, both men and women, people of all genders and races, this is not just for Alaska Native people, can come and share with us in the Women's Honor Song the dance, the choreography. I'm a dance artist in residence at the Scotiabank Dance Center in Vancouver. I had that position prior to this UAS position. So there's this strange overlap where I'm a resident there, but I'm working here right now. But I went back to Vancouver over spring break and worked to create the choreography for this dance, and finalized it just last week. So it's a brand new dance. The song was given to me 6 years ago now, so I'm very excited to share this with our local community here. And during our performance the next day, the people who feel comfortable participating during the time that we share this song, we're inviting them to come on to the floor and to dance our Women's Honor song with us. And if they don't feel comfortable, I know it's kind of a quick turnaround. It's a two-hour workshop, and then the performance is the next day. They're welcome to stand up in the audience in recognition of their participation in the workshop. So it's just where people are at. It's one way for us to connect more intimately and deeper with our community here.
How does it feel for you when you're in the midst of one of these performances?
How does it feel? Amazing. I've been dancing since I was 4 years old. I started dancing in Metlakatla, where I grew up with the Xta dancers, and that was all elementary through high school, fourth generation dancers, the Tsimshian Hayuk, the Githon, and so dancing has been a part of my life, my entire life. And this, I feel, in terms of artistic expressions, that this is my first art form, and it's an ancient art form amongst our people to express who we are and in our language, through our movements, through our masks. And there's no other feeling. In our language, we would say "lusanathisk." It's amazing.
Okay. So just to recap, the workshop will be from 6 to 8 at the UAS Recreation Center, the Rec Center there on Back Loop Road in Ok Bay,
yes.
Right there from 6 to 8. Is there a cost for that?
No, everything is free.
Okay.
And when you get to the Rec Center, or if you're unsure where the dance studio is, there's a reception desk right there. Just ask them where the dance studio is. It's a beautiful, brand-new hardwood floor, so they prefer no shoes. There's a nice little rack to put your shoes in when you get there. And
you say everyone's invited.
Everyone's invited. And this is UAS's first annual spring art showcase, and we're hoping to do this showcase every year to feature a different art form, artistic practice, and whether it's an individual, a solo artist, or a collective like our dance group, every year for here on out. So this is the very first one, and We're absolutely honored to be here, to make this place more of our home by sharing our songs and dances, and to UAS for this opportunity, and for Ahuan, whose territory that we're in out there at UAS, for allowing us to share songs and dances in their territory.
Okay, and then on Saturday, from 6 to 7:30, sort of closer inside to the middle of campus, I guess, at the UAS Egan Library, and mm-hmm. that's the performance.
Yes, that's the full-length performance. We're dancing for an hour and a half. Within that time period, as I said, we'll be sharing over 35 masks and headdresses, ancient songs that have been passed down through our families to us, as well as more recently created songs and those that my husband and I have created together to talk about who we are as 21st century Indigenous people.
Okay, and I should have asked you, I guess, at the top of the interview, but tell us a little bit more about what you teach at UAS.
Yes, so what I'm currently teaching, and this is a very Tsimshian-focused semester for me, which is beautiful. So I'm teaching a course right now on Tsimshian culture and history with a focus on our community of Metlakatla, and then I'm teaching Tsimalgech, the Tsimshian language. And last semester I taught Northwest Coast art history, which is what I received my PhD in. It's my specialization, both visual and performing arts in along the Northwest Coast. So I'm a professor of Alaska Native Studies is my title. So I'll be teaching Introduction to Alaska Native Studies, as well as a lot of other courses in relation to my areas of specialization. And this Tsimalgech course that I'm teaching right now at UAS Juno is the first time the Juno campus has had an accredited Tsimalgech course. And we have some really strong and dedicated learners, and it's a commitment that UAS is making to Alaska Native languages, that this is it's the level one and level two is going to be offered every year after this. That's really exciting. The first of a long series that's going to strengthen our endangered language.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Is there anything we're missing or anything else that you would like to add?
No, I think that we covered it all. Just for my Tsimalgech speaking people in out there, Tsimalgech Nidzisim at a I just said to them, I'll see them all again, and wish them all the best in everything that they do.
And will you teach me how to say thank you?
Oh, so quick Tsimalgech lesson here. Lots of signage all over Juno says what appears to be Doyekshin with a D, but Doyekshin in Tsimalgech means put on a warm coat. So which is proper. It's been pretty cold up here, but not all year round. So to say thank you in Tsimalgech is Int-Oyachsen, a really light N and a T. It's a T with apostrophe, T stop. Int-Oyachsen.
Int-Oyachsen.
Oh. Pizza. Almost.
Dr. Michael D'Angeli, thank you so much for coming on the show today. UAS Rec Center this Friday from 6 to 8 to see the Geet Hayek dancers, and also on from 6 to 7:30 at the UAS Egan Library. And is the performance free too?
Yes, everything is free. We wanted to make sure to offer this as widely and as most accessible as possible. So everything is free.
And Doyaksen.
And Oyaksen Noon and Oyaksen Newsom.
Thank you. things I've noticed over the last 2 or 3 years, it doesn't matter if I'm feeling bad, if I'm tired, if I'm sick, when I leave, I feel uplifted. I feel like I've got some kind of new energy.
I went into the group late in life, so let's just say I matured up to my age with the dance group. Before I was this age, but I was reckless. But now it gives me more to think about.
Every week it feels like I haven't seen my family every day, so without them I wouldn't know where I would be. And outside of the group, I'm a really shy person, and it gives me the opportunity to be who I want to be and to show people who my ancestors are.
Recently, I started doing the mask dances. So when I put my mask on for the first time, I had this adrenaline going through me, and I was so nervous. And I wasn't too sure if I could get through it or not. And I just, like, didn't really have time to worry about it, but I just had all these feelings, like, wow, I'm doing this in front of all these people. I was just so nervous, but all of a sudden I got through it because I had John, my husband, beside me, and I have family, and I have the group that's all so supportive. So when I'm out there, I feel like somebody special.
I lost my sister, and I stepped away from the group for a while, and when I came back, my first dance back, it was the North Wind. And it felt like it just blew my pain away.
Like a healthy family, because we do the communicating that is involved, whether it's positive or not. We still talk about, even though sometimes it might be hard to talk about.
I never knew anything about my culture or anything until I met up with the Kitayaks, and I have come a long way. I'm learning my language, all the traditions that I never knew before. We weren't taught until we came to this group. And then we learned. I learned. And the kids learned. My grandkids and my daughters. And it really meant an awful lot to us.
It was in us to start a group. We'd grown up in dance groups our entire life. And we knew no other way of being in the world. It's an incredible honor, and it's an incredible responsibility.
So leadership of the Get Hayeks is many things. It's family, it's responsibility, it's joy, it's sometimes difficult. And the difficulties are more of working together and getting over this idea of constantly having to just survive. And the one thing that Michael and I really talk about through a lot of our performances, when we sing our victory song, we talk about how we honor our rich, complex history of where we come from, but we're also honoring the richness and complexities of where we're coming from now as 21st century Aboriginal people. Those difficulties of teaching each other and moving beyond these things that have been thrusted upon us by the government and residential schools and missionization, I think that they still stick with us, but moving beyond that and thriving.
News coverage is becoming a rare commodity in today's media landscape. Serious journalism is expensive. It takes time to prepare and requires a large and talented team of reporters, editors, and producers. That's why listener-supported news and information on KTOO is more important than ever. Your contribution goes right back into bringing you the news you depend on all year round. Make sure your membership is up to date at ktoo.org.
Support comes from Wild Oven, providing Juno with handmade organic breads delivered fresh to Foodland, Super Bear, and Rainbow Foods. Wild Oven, Juno's artisan bread.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. And we were just listening to Git Hayek's video. It's called The Lives Behind the Dance. And if you Google Git Hayek and Hayek's, so it's GitHayetsk. Again, that's GitHayetsk. If you Google them, you can find The Lives Behind the Dance to watch that video. And again, those performances are this Friday and this Saturday. And you can also find them on Facebook for more information about these the workshop and the performance. And now my next guest on the show is Annie Bartholomew, Arts, Culture, and Music Director here at K2 and Director of KXLL's Music. Welcome to the show, Annie.
Thanks, Scott.
Nice to have you here. So I think, is this the second year in a row for the KXLL Showcase at Folk Fest, or three already?
No, it's just the second year.
Okay. So this KXLL Showcase happens usually on Friday night, usually, or I guess it was Saturday.
So last year I got the idea after going to South by Southwest, all these cool radio stations and breweries have their own little pockets of music, and I wanted to bring it here to Juneau. So we set it up during the break in the afternoon on Saturday, and that was amazing. People showed up. I expected everybody to take naps.
This was at the Alaskan, right?
It was at the Alaskan. It just had, like, the perfect vibe. But there was some issues since it was our first year. We didn't have enough seating. We didn't have enough bartenders. We didn't have a sound person. And
growing pains.
it was a hot, hot mess. But the community was really supportive. And we've learned from our mistakes, happy accidents, and moved it over to the Hangar Ballroom. We're doing it on a Friday night. And we got Alaska Music One doing sound, so it's going to sound excellent.
Happy Accidents. I love it. Sounds like a band name.
Yeah, it's actually Bob Ross. But
right. Okay, so it's Friday from 10 to whenever.
10 to whenever.
During Folk Fest. Let's just frame this. Let's see. I guess that's about the 8th-ish. What do you remember what the date is that Friday of Folk Fest? We'll look for that in just a sec, but Folk Fest is in, it's not next week, but it's the week after that, and it'll be that Friday of Folk Fest. I think Folk Fest starts on April 3rd, which
it's
is a Monday.
It's the
7th. Okay.
The 7th.
March 7th at the Hangar Ballroom, which that week they're going to be doing music, right?
Yeah, Charles Harrington of the Hangar has been working pretty hard to create an additional stage there. They're doing open mics, scheduled performances, and we're really grateful to get that big headlining Friday night slot.
Okay, and so then KXL comes out on Friday at 10 p.m. and closes. Who's going to be playing?
Ooh, I'm pretty excited. We got Goldwing for the second year in a row. They're going to be our big headliners. That's Dan Kirkwood's band. Got Dan DeSlover, Clay Good, and Ben Higdon in there. Super great. He calls it space country. It's kind of like where country meets surf rock meets rock. And Dan's been in New York for a while performing there, so I'm hoping he brings back a new modern sound to Juneau to share during the Alaska Folk Festival. We also got the Quaintrells, that's Taylor Vidic and Cameron Brockett, as their duo, which I haven't seen, it seems like, for a couple years. So they're going to be on the KXL stage as well. Also got songwriter Nicole Church, who is one of my favorites, and Jacob Picard is going to be there as well doing some kind of set. And then the one I'm really, really, really excited about is this seven-piece women's vocal ensemble called Queens. Simply Queens, seven ladies around one microphone.
Not the Queens, just Queens.
Just Queens, all capital letters with a colon. And then, at least that's how it's read on the poster. And that's made up of Kate Ross, Celia Montalto, who's a KXL DJ, Rasha McChesney, of course, from the Energy Desk here at K2. Also got Alyssa Abrams, Elizabeth Enkins, Taylor Vidic, and Cameron Brockett rounding out that group. So it's going to be a full night of music. It's going to have some kind of down-tempo stuff at the beginning, and then hopefully get really loud and exciting, but not too loud. This is a folk festival, so.
You spoke to it a little bit about inspiration from South by Southwest. What more is how is this going to be different from what else is going on at Folkfest? What do you like about this setting?
It's kind of a listening room setting, or that's what they're going for this year. I love the hall and everything about that, and I love the bars and everything about that. But there's something about you go to Centennial Hall, you see the best 12, 13, 15 minutes of your life, and then they're like gone. They disappeared. And, you know, sometimes you want to hear more. And so that's one thing we can provide at the Hangar Ballroom is this additional stage. I kind of got the idea last year when I heard Taylor V and the Boys, which is Taylor's band, on the main stage driving into town on a Friday night and just went, these guys would be perfect to hear a little bit more. So we've got it. The lineup's full, and it's going to be pretty rock and roll.
Do you know if there's going to be an admission charge to get into that?
Nope. This is public media. We just want you to be there. It is 21 and over, though, which is the drag. Eventually, Juneau will have an under 21 venue. Cross my fingers. It's part of the 5-year plan to infiltrate downtown. So 21 and over, no cover. Just come out and support local music.
Okay, so again, this is on Friday, April 7th at 10 p.m. at the Hangar Ballroom. Usually Folkfest, the main stage is starting to wind down by then, and some people, if they're not going to the dances, maybe they're heading downtown to find some live music, and the Hangar Ballroom's right on their way, right?
Oh, yeah, and there's so much to do. You could just stop in for a few minutes and go over to the next bar or dance band or main stage. We don't really want to compete with those things. We just want to offer something different and carve out a niche for our local performers.
All right. Annie Bartholomew talking about the KXL Showcase during the Folk Festival. It's Friday night at Folk Festival, 10 p.m. at the Hangar Ballroom. Anything else that you would like to add?
I'm just really excited to be doing this for a second year. Quality control.
All right. Here is some Goldwing.
And I hope that we collide. And I'll give
Can listen or watch that entire concert, the Gold Wings concert, recorded back in 2015 at 360 here in the KTOO building. If you go to 360north.org, the video is available, like many of the concerts, or I should say all the concerts we do downstairs, available on demand at 360north.org. And just go to the Arts at 360 tab and watch those great concerts. You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. It's about 22 minutes until the top of the hour.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 22nd of March, 2017. It's the birthday of composer-lyricist Stephen Sondheim, born 1930 in New York City. He was 9 years old when he went to see his first Broadway musical. It was called Very Warm for May. Sondheim said the curtain went up and revealed a piano. A butler took a duster and brushed it up, tinkling the keys. I thought that was thrilling. Grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. His father was a dress manufacturer. When he was 10, he made friends with James Hammerstein, the son of the lyricist Oscar Hammerstein, who took Sondheim under his wing, and he went on to write the lyrics for West Side Story and to write A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Into the Woods, and Sweeney Todd. It's the birthday of the author who has the most New York Times number one bestsellers of any author around, who sells more than Stephen King, Dan Brown, and John Grisham combined. And that would be James Patterson, turning 70 years old today, born in Newburgh, New York, 1947, whose books are published by Little Brown, which has a team of 12 staffers devoted to handling Patterson's books and Patterson only. It's the birthday of poet Billy Collins, born in New York in 1941. Billy Collins, who once said, "While the novelist is banging on his typewriter, the poet is watching a fly in the window pane." His mother was a nurse, father was an electrician, went off to Holy Cross College, started publishing his poems in the back of Rolling Stone magazine, came out with his first book when he was 40 years old. His latest book is The Rain in Portugal. Billy Collins, who uses a Uniball Onyx micropoint pen and writes in small notebooks. It's the birthday of the novelist Louis L'Amour, born in Jamestown, North Dakota, 1908, author of many novels, How the West Was Won, The Quick and the Dead, and so forth. Dropped out of school when he was 15, traveled around the West, worked as a ranch hand, lumberjack, got a job on an East African schooner, made his way from Africa to Asia, lived in the mountains of China, started boxing professionally, came back home, started writing for pulp fiction magazines. His first big success was Hondo, about a love triangle between a cowboy, an Apache warrior, and a young widow living on a remote ranch in Arizona. And it was on this date in 1621, the first treaty between white European colonists and Native American people was signed between the Wampanoag chief Massasoit and the Plymouth colonists. Here's a poem by Wendell Berry, "What a Wonder I Was." What a wonder I was when I was young, as I learn by the stern privilege of being old, how regardlessly I stepped the rough pathways of the hillside woods, treaded hardly thinking the tumbled stairways of the steep streams, and worked unaching hard days, thoughtful only of the work, the passing light, the heat, the cool water I gladly drank. A poem by Wendell Berry from A Small Porch, published by Counterpoint and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices, subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org, and by Lumosity, brain training with over 50 challenging games, from scientists working with university researchers to push cognitive research forward. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KRNN proudly presents the broadcast of the 43rd Annual Alaska Folk Festival, kicking off on April 3rd at 7 p.m. Listen live each night on KRNN 102.7 or view the live web stream at krnn.org. This broadcast is made possible by generous support from McDonald's of Southeast Alaska, Chatham Electric, and the University of Southeast Alaska. The Alaska State Folk Festival, live on KRNN, April 3rd through the 9th.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, March 22nd. It's about 18 minutes until the top of the hour, and we have a little extra time on the show today, so I did a randomly selected story from Mudrooms, and it looks like it's going to be the one by Brian Weed from October 2016. The theme that night was called Skeletons in the Closet. Note that tomorrow night, Thursday night, on K2 104.3, we'll be playing the entire episode of the March 8th show from this year, Rude Awakenings. It's a great partnership K2 has with Mudrooms, which is an excellent event that we get to broadcast that entire show. Again, that will be tomorrow night, Thursday, on KTOO 104.3. In the meantime, here is Brian Weed from October 2016 and the show Skeletons in the Closet.
Our next speaker tonight is Brian Weed. Brian is a local historian and photographer, born and raised in Juneau, Alaska. He has spent the last 5 years exploring off-trail, looking for hidden history, the man-made and the natural. Please welcome Brian.
Thanks. I would have had a longer introduction, but the skeletons in the closet theme went well with my work schedule this week. I'm working the grave shift. So had to write my own introduction, kept it pretty short just because I think I wrote it in the half hour I was awake this week. So I'm going to be looking at my paper a little more than I usually do just because I'm going to work right after this. So my story starts about a month ago. We were headed up to Gastineau Peak. There was six of us, and we went to explore this mine called the Groundhog Mine. Right next to it is another mine called Lurvy Creek. They're two small mines most people have never heard of. They're on a ridge on the backside of Gastineau Peak that most people don't go to, because once you head down to that ridge. There's really no way off it. So we decided to cheat that day, and we got some free tickets from my friend Greg, and we shot up the tram to cut off 1,200 feet, even though we're the hardcore group. And so we get to the top of Gastineau Peak, and during that time, we're taking photos of each other. We're posting on Facebook as we're climbing. And halfway up, somebody makes a comment on our Facebook page, "Why don't you guys go live?" And I was like, "Facebook live? What's that?" And sure enough, I scroll down in my Facebook, and there's a button that says live. So we hit the live button, and lo and behold, people start popping into our live feed, and they're commenting as we're hiking up this mountain. So we're looking down one way, and I'm like, there's a drop-off right here, and there's a drop-off right there. And I'm moving my phone back and forth as I'm showing people this hillside. Well, my friend Jeff and I were the fastest ones in the group, and we got to the ridge before everybody else and started heading down to the mine site. And I always get really excited when we get to new mine sites. When I see old buildings and man-made objects, immediately I speed up. I start talking faster. I start pointing things out. I'm basically a mile ahead of the group. Well, luckily, my friend Jeff was fast enough to keep up with me. And lo and behold, as we come down this ridge, there's people working at this mine site. And I'm like, who would be working this mine site? We get to this ditch, and it's 8 feet deep. And there's a man in his 40s digging in this ditch with a 12-year-old boy. And they're clearing the ditch so water will flow faster. And Jeff's standing next to me, and he's looking down in the ditch, and he says, "What kind of shovel is that?" And the man looks up at me and says something in German. And I kind of look at Jeff, and Jeff looks back at me, and I say, "Oh, it's a gooseneck shovel. Probably 100 years old." And so Jeff, "I've never seen one like that before." And so I kind of nod to the two digging in the ditch, because obviously they don't speak English. The boy never looked up at me. And we continued off towards the mine site. As we get to where we're looking out over this mine site, you can see a rock wall, and there's a man stacking rocks near this rock wall, kind of building a little reservoir. Over by some cabin ruins, there's a man sitting there smoking a pipe. And I'm like, this place is supposed to be abandoned. You know, we're in the middle of nowhere. Well, and I hear two people arguing. But I can't tell where they are, so we work our way closer to this mine. And I pull out my camera and tripod, and I'm like, I'm going to get pictures of this. Well, Jeff's exploring a little higher on the hillside, and I set up the tripod and the camera, and I take a picture of this guy stacking rocks, making this little reservoir for these sluice boxes that they're getting ready to use. And I take a few pictures of him, and he just kind of looks at me, and I said, "You know, how long have you been doing this?" And he goes, "Well, I've been working on this wall now for 2 days. And that's when I realized he wasn't wearing gloves. You know, his hands were all cut and tore, and it was cold out. He was stacking these rocks, like, yay big. The wall was about 4 feet high, 100 feet long. I was like, man, that's hard work. So I took a few pictures of him and continued on towards the mine site and started walking past one of the mine adits that were in the area, a mine tunnel. And I looked in, and there's about shin-deep water in there. And there's two guys, and they're arguing over how much gold is in this vein in this mine tunnel. And these two guys are just bickering back and forth, and they're holding this little small white candle as they're pointing at this vein. And one of them goes to point aggressively at the other man, and he drops the candle. And it goes sploop in the water. Well, of course, they start arguing louder because now they can barely see. The tunnel itself isn't very long, so they can kind of see down it. And, you know, Jeff kind of looks at me, and I'm like, "Hey, there's a tunnel right here." And he's like, that's really cool, but did you see this eye bolt up here?" And I was like, "Oh, that's part of an aerial tramway." And Jeff was in the way of this guy who was pounding that eye bolt into the cliff. And, you know, Jeff kind of looked at me and then headed off down the hill. The guy pounding in the eye bolt kind of shrugged at me and continued pounding in the eye bolt. I rounded the corner, and there's this old man sitting there smoking a pipe. And he's looking out over Silver Bow Basin, and he's got this hat sitting next to him on a rock. And the hat, it's made of felt or leather. It was a soft material. And I sat down next to him and said, "Nice hat." And he nodded to me and took a couple puffs on his pipe. And he said, "Winter's coming." And he said, "Freeze up will be here soon." And I said, "Are you coming back next year?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, there's still plenty of gold in these hills." Well, my friend Jeff came up behind me and sat down to the left of me. And he said, "Who are you talking to?"
That is the voice of Brian Weed. And he told that story as part of the October 2016 Skeletons in the Closet Mudrooms event. To listen to that story or others like it, you can go to mudrooms.org. And just a reminder that you can also hear the March 2017 edition of Mudrooms. Rude Awakenings was a theme. You can hear that tomorrow night, Thursday, the 23rd of March, on KTOO 104.3. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, March 22nd.
This is Bird Note. What a lovely song! The very sound of spring. A mellow, burbled refrain from the edge of a meadow. A shimmer of blue against the still wintry landscape confirms our eager hope. An eastern bluebird has just returned north. A male bluebird stands atop a wooden nest box attached to a fence post. He's an eastern bluebird, a small thrush, and he gleams deep blue with a rusty orange breast. The bluebird's song and his alert presence assert his claim to this territory. But an intruder, a tree swallow, dives toward the nest box. With a rough chatter and raised wings, the bluebird warns the swallow away. Bluebirds rely on nest boxes. In the mid-20th century, their numbers in the Northeast declined to the lowest level ever, due largely to nesting competition from non-native starlings and house sparrows. Conservation groups stepped up, setting out bluebird trails of nest boxes built just right for these beautiful birds. Eastern bluebirds have rebounded, and we can still count on them to welcome the arrival of spring. Today's show is brought to you by White Flower Farm, a family-owned mail-order nursery offering a wide range of perennials, annuals, and shrubs for spring planting. More information is at whiteflowerfarm.com.
Support for this program comes from the Prospector Hotel. The hotel is pet-friendly and features non-smoking accommodations, an on-site restaurant, and parking. Reservations at 586-3737 or prospectorhotel.com.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow on the show, Joan Partis will be your host, and she'll get a preview of The Northwest Passage, A Tale of Two Transits, a presentation by Linda Micklin and Teresa Sthankar. Leslie Wood will be here with a preview of this Saturday's concert by the P-Flag Juno Pride Chorus, and Erin Kirkland will talk about her new book about traveling with kids aboard the Alaska Marine Highway. And as always, Nancy DeCherney will be here with arts news during Arts Up. Let's take a look at the weather. It's currently 43 degrees at the Juneau International Airport. Forecast for tonight calls for scattered rain showers before 10, then snow showers likely. Cloudy with a low around 32. New accumulation of snow less than half an inch. Tomorrow, Thursday, snow showers before 10 a.m., then rain showers likely. High near 40. And going into Friday calls for mostly sunny with a high near 40. East winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Thank you for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon.